Now it's time for our afternoon theatre play. It's by Geoffrey Segal, based on the novel of the same name by J.D. Beresford, and it's called The Hamdenshire Wonder.
Oh, excuse me.
Only just in time, eh?
Afraid so. But there's no other train that stops at Aylesworth for an hour or so.
Quite. Yes, that's what I'm bound for, Aylesworth.
Ah. My heart sank a little at the information. I'm not one who particularly enjoys the conversation of fellow travellers, and I was happy to have the excuse of my breathlessness for making no more than a brief rejoinder. By the time I'd recovered, I was deeply immersed in the book I had with me. And I barely noticed the woman with the child who got on at one of the train's frequent stops. They had been sitting in one of the seats opposite me for some time before I became aware that I was reading and rereading the page open before me. The words there conveyed no meaning to me. My attention was being pulled irresistibly elsewhere. As I looked up, the eyes of the infant sitting demurely on his mother's lap caught my own and held them. Its gaze was steady and clear as that of a normal child, but what differentiated it was the impression one received of calm intelligence. The child turned its head, and I felt my muscles relax. Until then, I had not been conscious that they'd been stiffened. My gaze was released, pushed aside, as it were, and I found myself watching the object of the child's next scrutiny. This was my would-be loquacious travelling companion. He, too, had been reading until the child's gaze claimed his attention. And he, too, was held motionless by that strange, appraising stare. When he was released, his surprise found vent in words.
That's a remarkable child, ma'am.
Yes, sir.
The woman who answered him, if she was indeed the child's mother, was older than one might have expected, well into her 40s. And while dressed soberly and becomingly, had an air of belonging to an older fashion. Her face was not that of a countrywoman. The thin, high-bridged nose, the untidy black eyebrows, the shadows under her pale, introspective eyes denoted the town and confinement within doors. The child, meanwhile, its great bald head shining resplendently like a globe of alabaster, now focused indefinitely on some point outside the carriage window. It seemed remote, utterly unconcerned with any human being.
Very remarkable. Can it talk?
No, sir. He's never made a sound.
Dumb, eh?
He's never spoke, sir.
Not water on the brain, eh?
Oh, no, sir, no. He's got more sense than an ordinary child.
How old is he?
1 year and 9 months.
Ought to have spoken before that, or
never even cried, sir.
Have you had a doctor for him?
Oh, yes, sir.
And what do they say?
At this point, the child turned its head and looked the interrogator full in the eyes. Never in the face of any human being have I seen such an expression of sublime pity and contempt. My fellow passenger, his mouth open, leant quickly back into his corner, and the infant, satisfied perhaps with its victim's ignominy, turned and looked at me with a cynical smile. I was, as it were, taken into its confidence. I felt undeservedly, yet enormously flattered.
Right, attendant! Right, attendant!
Oh, this is where we get out.
Allow me.
Thank you, sir. Good day, sir.
Good day. Good day. Well, what do you make of that?
Aye.
Water on the brain. Don't care what anyone says.
She, the mother, seemed certain it was not.
Well, what's your opinion then, sir?
Well, it certainly is a very remarkable child. By profession, I am a journalist, and it has been my good fortune to have avoided the drudgery of the mere reporter, in that those matters upon which I have been called to write have always been of particular concern and interest to me. In the case of cricket, this has at times amounted to a passion. The town of Aylesworth, for which I was bound when that encounter on the train took place, will always be associated for me with the Hamptonshire side in their brief hour of glory as county champions, and with the principal instrument of their victory, Ginger Stott. His phenomenal technique, in some measure the result of his having taught himself to bowl in the narrow strip of yard behind his mother's paper shop, involved getting the ball to swerve. No easy task when bending the arm at the elbow is forbidden. He did this by spinning the ball with a twist of his immensely powerful middle finger and thumb at the same time as his arm, lithe and flexible, was rapidly on the move. No batsman ever succeeded in standing up to him for any appreciable length of time, and there were many who feared that as long as he held sway, it could mean an end to first-class cricket. But, as history knows, it was not so. Stott's accident saw to that. During a match against Notts at Trent Bridge, Stott, at cover point, had gone for a rising ball, and the seam had caught his vital middle finger, splitting the skin of its tip. A series of unlucky circumstances led to the finger becoming infected, and by the beginning of the following week, the only course open to the doctors was to amputate. Stott's career as a cricketer was over. The club stood by him, and he continued with them as groundsman and bowling coach, a position that occasioned him considerable chagrin and frustration.
Oh, look at that.
That's the third six he's been hit for this over.
I can't learn him nothing. Half volleys and long hops and then a full pitch. He's a disgrace, that Flower.
They've knocked him off his length. On a wicket like
I've
this...
I've been trying to learn him, but it's no use. He's got habits you can't break him of.
I suppose it is difficult.
It's the same with me. I've been trying to learn myself to bowl without my finger. Or left-handed. But I can't. Now, if I'd started that way... No. I'm always feeling for that finger as is gone. In time, maybe. But second class, no better than that.
It's early days, yeah?
I'm not going to kid myself. I know. Fact, I've been looking around.
Huh?
Well, as I see it, if I could get hold of some youngster and learn him, only he must be young. No habits, you know?
Oh, I see what you're getting at.
Oh, God. I can hardly bear to look at this. If you'll excuse me, Mr. Davis.
I'll come with you. I'm afraid it's a foregone conclusion.
Do you know Stoke Underhill, Mr. Davis?
A couple of miles from here, up the valley.
That's right.
Pretty place.
I've took a cottage there.
Oh. You're leaving your mother's place?
Mm-hmm. I'm to be married in a few weeks' time.
Oh, well, that's very nice. Of course, your place here is a groundsman.
Yes. And the money from the benefit, that's invested. I reckon I can afford it, all right.
Well, I'm sure you can.
Yeah.
Let me offer my congratulations. I hope you're very happy.
Well, as to that, sir, better wait and see.
It is a lottery, of course.
Huh? Oh, that. Well, I take my chance on that. No, it's the kid I'm thinking of.
The kid?
Well, what else would I tie myself up for? I must have a kid of my own and learn him from his cradle. It's come to that.
I see. Teach him to bowl.
That's it. Have him right from his cradle before he's got habits.
And you hope a boy of your own?
Oh, not hope. It's a cert. I'll see no boy of mine touches a ball afore he's 14. And then he'll learn from me, and learn right from the first go-off. My God, he'll be a bowler such as has never been.
I was unable to attend Stott's wedding. I was, in fact, in America, and the ensuing 2.5 years broke up for a time many of my old habits of thought, among them, amazingly, my devotion to cricket. True, I wondered occasionally about Stott and how his marriage had turned out. Indeed, on the day of that train journey to Aylesworth, passing through Stoke Underhill, he had briefly crossed my mind. But the encounter with the child eclipsed all else. Another couple of months of English life, however, and I found myself reverting to old tastes and interests. And although the season had virtually ended, cricket once more began to occupy my thoughts, and with it, curiosity about Stott and his ambition. On inquiry, I learned that he had left Stoke Underhill for the village of Pym, and it was a fine Sunday in late September when I set out on the 4-mile walk from Great Hittenden Station. Some distance up a little lane, which had been pointed out to me at the side of the pond, I came upon Stott's dwelling. The door was open, and I peered in. Sitting in a rocking chair was a woman with black, untidy eyebrows, and on her lap, held with rigid attention, was the remarkable baby I had seen in the train 2 months before. As I stood, doubtful, and, I will confess it, intimidated, the child opened his eyes and honored me with a cold stare. Then he nodded, a reflective, recognizable nod.
He remembers seeing you in the train, sir. He never forgets anyone.
Cigarette, Stott?
Oh, far, sir.
That's a very remarkable baby of yours. How old is he?
Nearly 2 years.
Can he talk yet?
He can, but he won't.
Oh. How do you know? Well, sure he can. Look, don't you want to talk about the child?
I've heard him speak once. And speak proper, too. Not like a baby.
What did you hear him say?
I don't know. Something about learning and talking. I didn't get the rights of it. And the missus near fainted. She thinks he's God Almighty or something.
Why did you make him speak?
Make him? Oh, make him. Well, you tried on.
Well, why not?
Because he'd look at you. That's why not. And you can't no more face him than a dog can face a man.
Yes.
I shan't stand it much longer.
Curious. Very curious.
He's a blasted freak, that's what he is. Just to think of all the trouble I took when he was coming. There was nothing the missus fancied as I wouldn't get. Not as she was difficult. I mustn't get habits, George, she used to say. Got that from me. I was always on about that then. You know, the thinking of learning him to bowl.
Yes, yes, I remember.
Learn him bowling. Oh, my God.
Well?
No fear. The game's off. Oh, I could have done it if he'd been a decent, ordinary child instead of a blasting freak.
Can he walk?
Yeah, gets about easy enough. For all his body and his legs is so small. When the missus tries to stop him, she's afraid he'll go over like. He just looks at her. And she has to let him have his own way.
The time he spoke, was he alone?
In the garden, practicing walking all by himself.
And was that the only time?
Only time I've heard him.
Lately, was this?
About 6 weeks ago.
But he never made a sound otherwise. Cried? Laughed?
Hardly. He gives a sort of grunt sometimes when he wants anything. And points.
He's very intelligent. Abnormally so.
Worse than that. He's a freak, I tell you.
Well, I must be on my way.
Oh, you're not coming up? Take a bite or something?
Well, I have to catch that train.
Of course. We don't have many visitors.
No, you are a bit remote here.
I'll walk back to the road with you.
I suppose, leaving all personal considerations of friendship for the man aside, what was aroused in me most by this strange situation was the journalist, the observer and interpreter. Knowledge of a unique phenomenon had come my way, and, so far as I knew, my way alone. Here was something for me to tell the world about. But it must be something more than the bald facts. And the very next day found me in the reading room of the British Museum, looking for precedents, for similarities to which I might relate Ginger Stott and his blasted freak. There had, as I suspected, been similar cases of precocity, but the Stott child, Victor, they had christened him, was somewhat different. At two, he had done no study, gathered no knowledge from books, nor from any other person, and yet appeared possessed of a wonderful intellect with great powers of memory and deduction. Was he perhaps withholding his energy deliberately, keeping prodigious faculties in reserve, And then it came to me. From a few remembered phrases of his father's.
No habits. I'll learn him from the cradle before he's got habits. That's what I'll do. No, George. I mustn't get habits, George, she used to say. Not if he's to have none.
That was it. The great restraining force in the evolution of man has been the restriction imposed by habit. What we call instinct is an hereditary habit, and upon this instinct, already there in the human infant, we immediately superimpose the habits of conformity, all the bodily and intellectual conventions that have been handed down from generation to generation. And the child learns by the hereditary simian habit of imitation. And yet here, by some freak of nature, was a child born without that. And I would have some part in his life, in submitting knowledge to his reason, in standing between him and the delimiting training of the pedagogue. But circumstances in the immediate event dictated otherwise. This is not my own story, and the nature of the sudden upheaval in my own life, which took me to the other side of the world, need not concern us here. Suffice it to say that it was half a dozen years before I was in England again, and found my life intertwined with that of the wonder child. What you will now learn of the life of Victor Stott in those years comes from the first-hand experience of a number of people, not least his mother, Ellen Mary. And we must go back now to the occasion of her first meeting with the man who was to be her husband, and to father upon her the Hamptonshire wonder.
I've seen your mother, George.
Where? Yeah.
She was telling me, well, she gave me her confidence, like.
What about?
You.
Me?
This here plan of yours, since your accident.
Oh. Well, I don't suppose there's no harm you knowing. You're a friend of hers. Still, I...
You don't think about it?
What do you mean?
Well, you want to have a son? You have to be the greatest cricketer in the world?
Well, the greatest bowler, yes.
Well, you done anything about it? Do you have anyone in mind?
Oh,
for his mother. You're not keeping company with anyone?
No.
Well, that's what your mother said. Not much opinion of women, she said.
No, not really. I mean, you see a girl trying to throw a cricket ball, huh? Put you off women for life.
So are you going to have a son?
Oh, well, that's different.
Is it? You need someone to bear him, won't he? Bring him up, look after him.
You mean...
Someone who knows about your plan for him? Well, go along with it. Keep it in mind all the time she's carrying, not to mention when he's born. No habits. That's what your mum said you wanted, that right?
Yeah. And did she tell you that you might...
No. What worries her is some young flighty piece of goods getting her hands on your benefit money. No, what I've come to offer is only my idea.
Come to offer? You mean... God, you're a cool one.
And a bit forward, eh?
Yeah. I mean to say, you're not all that...
Pretty? No, George, but I'm not a fool. Not much book learning, I grant you, but I'm not a fool, never have been. Still, by the time I was 35, I knew for certain I wasn't likely to get a husband. And even if I had, would I have been likely to keep him? This is different. You want something special, George. Only thing is, I'm 42 now, so there's not much time.
My God. You are a cool one and no mistake.
And you hold that against me?
You don't care what people will say?
No. I know what it is you've set your eye on, George. I'll be a good wife to you. And all being well, I'll give it to you. What do you say?
Oh. I don't know. Still, I don't know why not.
She'll do, nurse, if there are no complications. Let her sleep as long as she likes.
Yes, doctor.
She's a wonderful woman to have delivered such a child alive, especially at her age.
Can't live.
Never cried after delivery. The worst sign. To be sure, it's a freak of some kind. Nurse.
Yes, doctor.
Come here.
Yes, doctor.
There seems to be complete paralysis of all the motor centers, but the child is not dead. We'll try artificial respiration.
Is it worthwhile? Wouldn't it be better to let it die?
Let's have none of that talk, nurse.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Quite outside my experience. No heartbeat, no breath, yet it is indubitably alive. There's the heart. Yes, beating now. But still no breath. Come along, nurse. Let's move its arms. You know how.
Its arms? Poor little thing.
It's more like twigs, I grant you, but come along.
There now. I saw its chest move.
Yes, it's breathing. Quite well, too. Right now, let's have a look at his eyes. Glory be.
He looked at you, Doctor.
Yes. Well, let's see. We'd better keep it separate from the mother for the time being. The next room is prepared, is it?
Yes.
Yes, well, you take it in there. I'll go and tell the father he can come up.
But, Doctor...
What? Now, come on, nurse, pick him up.
Yes, Doctor, but... Oh, his eyes are shut again.
Of course they are. He's a newborn baby. I'll be back later.
Come in, Mr. Stott.
Doctor didn't seem all that happy.
Didn't he?
Oh, my God. What a head. Here, nurse, it's... It's a wrong one, isn't it?
Oh, I'm sure I can't tell you, Mrs. Stott.
More like a tadpole than anything else.
Oh, Mr. Stott, for goodness sake, don't. If only you knew.
Knew what?
Well, there's something. You'll know when it opens its eyes.
Oh, what are you talking about?
Mr. Stott, the woman who's going to look after them, Mrs. Reed, shouldn't she be here by now?
She'll be here directly, but what do you mean, something? Something what?
I don't know. Uncanny.
Are you there?
Oh, Mrs. Reed? Yes, up here.
What do you mean, uncanny? How uncanny? What do you mean?
Shh, quiet.
Oh, God.
Mrs. Stott's sleeping still, but the baby's in here.
In here. Now, let's have a look at him. Oh, dear. Oh, how unfortunate. And her first, too. Oh, it'll be an idiot, I'm afraid.
What?
Oh, that head. Mrs. Harrison's third was the very spit of it. Oh, healthy, I dare say. It'll live. But helpless. I'll learn him everything. Learn him to open his mouth. Learn him to close his hands. Learn him everything.
Oh, God.
Lord help us. Did you see that? When he opened his eyes, he looked... Oh, Lord help us. He might have been 100 years old and wise with it. Look like that.
Nurse, I don't think it'll be necessary for me to come again.
Not come again?
I've seen them both every day for a week now and they're both doing perfectly well.
Perfectly well?
Well, that's to be expected. It's hydrocephalus with the baby, no doubt of that. There's nothing we can do.
Perhaps. I don't know, Doctor.
No doubt at all. But everything else is normal. Heart, breathing, taking nourishment. Not from the mother, I know, but you and Mrs. Reed are looking after that. So, if I'm wanted, you can easily send for me, all right?
Yes, Doctor.
I'll bid you good day, then.
Good day, Doctor.
Good day.
Lord, have mercy on us all.
Gone, has he?
Yes. And he won't be back unless we need him.
Oh, right, then. It's time she was told. Nay more, it's time she saw him. I've never held with keeping it from her myself. And I've had more experience than many.
But is she strong enough? Do you think she can bear the sight of him? I'm afraid it may turn her head.
She's his mother. And I can't say I haven't prepared the way. Never mind what you and the doctor have told me. Drop the odd hint I have here and there. Well, she knows he's not normal. But all the same, it's time she saw him. Time she held him.
Very well. Will you take him to her?
Oh. All right. While he's sleeping. Let's have him then. son, dear, at last. Oh.
Well?
I don't know. Didn't seem to worry her at all what he looked like.
Yes?
It was like, I don't know, it was like she was in church, like she'd seen a vision. Not that I'd say as much before the rector, you know what he's like, but I don't know. I never see anything like that look on her face. Never in all my born days.
Not yet baptized, Mrs. Stott?
Well, no, Mr. Crashaw, sir.
What is the child now, 6 weeks old?
Come this Thursday, yes.
A shameful neglect, Mrs. Stott. But then, as I recall, you were not married in the church here.
No, we was married in Aylesworth.
In church?
No. But we do want him baptized.
So I should hope.
We were thinking, though, my husband and me, that we'd like it private.
Private? Why?
Well, we both had a bad time, and he's not very strong.
Even if he were at death's door, there would still be no reason to avoid dedicating him to God before the whole congregation.
Oh, he's not ill, sir.
Then I don't see why the recognized practice should be altered, shall we say?
If we could leave it a little while yet.
Leave it? Have you no thought of his immortal soul? Every day delayed puts it in greater peril.
Yes, I know.
Let me see the child. Where is he?
He's just in here, sir, in his cot.
Yes.
He's asleep. Sleeps a lot, he does. No trouble.
Yes. Well, perhaps on second thoughts, a private ceremony might be arranged after all.
Do you think so, sir?
Yes, to exhibit the child before the congregation might... Yes. If you or your husband would let me know when will be convenient, I'll make the necessary arrangements. Godparents, is there anyone?
Just me and my husband. I think that's all right, isn't it?
Yes, that is permitted. Yes. Well, then.
Hello there. How do you do, Crashaw?
Why, Mr. Challis, this is quite a surprise.
I suppose it is. Mind you, I've been back at Challis Court for more than a week.
I hadn't heard. You were away a long time.
Best part of 3 years. Tell me, don't you have a new and distinguished parishioner?
Oh? Who is that?
Such is fame. Ginger Stott, the cricketer.
Ah, yes.
He just had his accident when I left. Are the good folk of Stoke Underhill basking in his former glory? Or is it all forgotten?
I'm afraid the Stott family have a certain notoriety in the parish, but not for that reason.
Oh? What then?
You don't know about the child.
Oh, they have a child.
If you can call it that.
Tell me.
Oh, I baptized it. I'm aware of my Christian duty, privately, of course. And even there I have my doubts as to whether I was right in administering that holy sacrament.
Why? What is it? An idiot? Deformed?
I would allow, I think, more latitude to medical men. Such a child becomes a burden on the community. I might even say a danger.
What on earth do you mean, ma'am?
The growth of lunacy is an ever-present danger.
The child's an imbecile, then?
I would say more than that. You probably have no belief in the positive existence of evil, of malign possession and incarnation.
No, you're right, Crashaw, I haven't. Do the rest of the people of Stoke share your view?
To a greater or lesser degree. The Stotts keep to themselves, of course. But the others give them as wide a berth as is possible in a small community.
I should like to see this black swan. It sounds exceptional, and anything exceptional interests me.
No doubt Mrs. Stott would be proud to exhibit the horror to you. No doubt.
Oh, forgive me for calling again so soon, Mrs. Stott.
Oh, not at all, Mr. Challis, sir. Won't you come in?
Oh, thank you. Ah, Mr. Stott, good evening.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Now, please don't let me interrupt your meal. Just carry on, both of you, and I'll sit down here, if I may.
No, not in that old armchair,
sir. No, really, this is fine. Since I came to see you and your son with the rector yesterday, I've been thinking. Would you say you were happy here?
Well, I...
Your neighbours. Would you say you got on with them?
Don't waste my time on them.
They're not highly intelligent, I suspect. Even Mr. Crashaw, I fancy, doesn't appreciate the peculiarities of the situation.
He's worse than any.
A little narrow, a little dogmatic, no doubt. Well, I was going to propose that you might like to live at Pym.
Oh.
There's an excellent cottage there, which I can have put in repair for you right away.
Pym? That's much further for me. For getting to the ground in Aylesworth.
No doubt, but you have other interests to consider. I understand that Mrs. Stott hardly takes the child out at all here.
Yes, sir. Well, I don't care to make an exhibition of him.
Quite right. But the child should have air. And you must be free, Mrs. Stott, to take him out in it. In Pym, you will have few neighbours. And you need not, I'm sure, fear their criticism.
They got one idiot up there already.
Oh, you surely don't regard your own child as likely to develop into an idiot.
Dr. O'Connor says it well.
When did he see him last?
Not since he were a week old.
Well, in that case, his authority goes for nothing. Oh, by the way, has the child been vaccinated?
Not yet, sir.
Well, better have that done. Oh, would you like me to arrange it? Dr. Walters, a very good man and a friend of mine.
Oh, well, it's very good of you, sir, to take the trouble.
Not at all. And I'll set things in train, shall I, as regards the cottage of Pym?
Yes.
Now, please, don't get up. I'll be on my way. Good evening to you both for the present.
Good evening, sir. Well, you ain't fair on that child, George. There's more there than you or anyone else sees. More than Mr. Challis, even. And it won't be so out of the way for you at Pym, not with your bike. And it's true, we can't stop here.
We might have taken a place in Aylesworth.
But it'll be so much healthier at Pym. It'll be fine air up there for him.
Oh, yes. All right for him. Just so long as it's all right for him.
Right.
Well, he's done it up real nice for us, Mr. Challis. Hasn't he, George?
Yeah. Still, it has got us away from that lot down there. And I didn't see no one about when we arrived.
Well, I spoke to the old couple next door. They seem to want to keep themselves to themselves.
Yeah. Well, suit me. What did I just say? Nobody about? Who's that hanging about down there?
Where?
Out in the lane, down by our fence.
Oh, that must be him.
Who?
Mrs. Harrison's boy. One what Mrs. Reed was always on about.
Oh, yeah. Great lolling head. You clear off, will you? Just get out of it before I take a stick to it.
It's all right, George. You can't get in. The gate's fastened.
All the same, I don't want him hanging about here.
He's going.
A great balmy lout.
George.
What?
Well, I ask you, George, is he anything like him in his cradle there?
Yeah. Of
course he isn't. You'll see. Grow up good and strong and healthy up here, this one will.
I'm here. It's my tea.
George, thought I heard you. Just getting your tea.
That child's in my chair.
Still, is he?
Well,
I did mention it, but he hasn't moved then.
Take him out.
Does it matter, George? Tea's just ready. Time that's done, he'll be ready for his bath.
Why can't you just move him? He knows that's my chair.
Oh, what a fuss about that old armchair. Don't know how you sit in it anyway.
That's neither here nor there. That's my chair. He should know that by now. First thing when I come in of an evening, I have a sit down in that chair.
I know.
And so does he know. He's old enough. He's seen me do it often enough.
George, he's only two.
Plenty old enough to have a bit of respect.
There's a tea made. Now come and sit at the table.
Just look at him. Just sitting there. Like we wasn't here at all.
Oh, sit down. Leave him be.
I'll be hanged if I will. Now look here, you. Just get out. That's my chair. Do you hear me?
George.
Look, I'm talking to you. You have got to get out of my chair. Don't you look at me like that. You've got to get out of my chair. I'll make you.
Oh, no.
God damn him. God damn him!
Who is God?
So that's what it comes to, I reckon. I've had enough. After what happened earlier, I reckon that's it.
You never going to teach him, then?
What? To be a bowler?
Ah.
Him? Oh, I gave up that idea long ago.
What will you do, George?
Find a room in Aylesworth near the ground, near my work. I can understand that, cricketing, you see. Not this, though. Not him.
I know.
How could you? I mean, you and me, we're just ordinary.
Not you, George. You're not ordinary. Greatest bowler ever, isn't that what they say?
Oh, that. Not anymore. It's all finished. But you've no cause to worry, Ellen. I know my responsibilities. You should have enough to keep you and him. I can make it 30 shillings a week with no trouble. But I've got to go. I got to get out.
I see.
You say that I married you and it's my duty to stay by you, but there it is.
I see.
Well?
Well, I'm sorry it's come to this, George. I knew it had to be sometime, but I don't think there's need to be any hard words over it.
My God. You always was the cool one.
Well, I don't mean to offend you, George.
Oh, I ain't offended. At least not that way. It's just that with him, that there's that about him that I don't know.
I don't expect you to understand him no more than I do myself. It ain't nature as you should, but all said and done, there's no bones broken. Well, if we have to part, why shouldn't we part reasonable?
Fair enough. I'll go tomorrow.
George, don't wish him no harm. He's different to us. And we don't understand him proper. Someday...
I don't wish him no harm.
You mayn't never see him again.
I suppose not.
You must forgive me, Mr. Crashaw, for not having been able to receive you before.
I was not even aware until recently that you had returned to Chalice Court.
Well, I have been back for some months, but occupied in a task that has required my undivided attention.
Indeed.
The work of scholarship, Mr. Crashaw. It's time I put something of what I've gained from my travels to good use. I'm preparing a monograph for the Royal Anthropological Institute. And Mr. Lewis, whom I think you've met, is assisting me. Oh, but there. So much for my excuses for not seeing you before. Your letter implied that it was a matter of some moment.
Yes, it is. Not perhaps entirely unconnected with the work you mentioned.
Oh? No Polynesians come to settle in Stoke, have they?
On broad lines connected, anthropological lines.
Go on.
You may remember that abnormal child of the Stotts. They were my parishioners.
Oh, yes, yes. They moved to Pym, 3 years ago. And the child?
Its development has upset me in a most unusual way. I really believe you are the only person who can give me any intelligent assistance in the matter.
Oh, very good of you.
You see, I happen to be the child's godfather.
Really?
By the merest accident. The baptism was a private ceremony, just the parents present, and therefore I, as the rubric ordains, stood as second godfather.
So you have responsibilities?
Undoubtedly. I am aware that on one point I can expect little sympathy from you, but I make an appeal to you, nevertheless, as a man of science and as a magistrate, for assistance.
And what do you want me to do, Mr. Cashel?
Have the child certified as an idiot and sent to an asylum.
On what grounds?
He is undoubtedly lacking mentally, and his influence is, or maybe, malignant.
Oh, yes, you hinted as much, I remember, when you first told me about him. In what way does this malignity manifest itself?
He has denied God.
I see.
I have myself heard this infant of 4 years utter the most abhorrent blasphemy.
That's bad.
I think you'll agree with me that something should be done.
Well, can you give me some details?
They are most repugnant to me.
I understand, but if you want my assistance...
Although they are no longer my parishioners, I thought it my duty as his godfather to see to his spiritual welfare. However, when I went to Pym some months ago, the mother would not permit me to see him. However, a few weeks back, I met him on the common alone.
And then?
I spoke to him, and he replied with an abstracted air and without looking at me. He has not the appearance in any way of a normal child.
No, that's true. A very large head, almost hydrocephalic, as I recollect. But with an abnormally intelligent expression.
You may have seen it as that. However, I asked him if he knew his catechism. He replied that he did not know the word. I may mention that he speaks the dialect of the common people hereabouts, but he has a much larger vocabulary. His mother has taught him to read, it appears.
Well, at 4 years of age, that would argue some degree of intelligence.
I then spoke to him of some of the broad principles of the church's teaching. He listened quietly, and then when I stopped, he began asking me questions.
What sort of question?
I don't remember precisely. One, I think, was as to the sources of the Bible, questions which betrayed an unusual curiosity in a child so young, but...
But no signs of idiocy.
Worse. At the end of my instruction, this creature shook his misshapen head and informed me that what I had said was not true and could not be true.
This is the blasphemy you spoke of.
Isn't it enough? To defy a minister of the church? To pour scorn on its teaching? To repudiate the very conception of the deity? What is it but the clearest indication of maleficent possession? Oh, I wonder I didn't strike and injure the child.
I hope you didn't.
I was too overcome. Overcome by the implication of what was happening. Just think. If it became known that an unlettered infant, the child of ignorant parents, was freely questioning the authority of the church and its place in society, then anarchy, revolution, chaos could not be far away.
Nevertheless, you cannot confine a child in an asylum on those grounds. The law does not permit it.
The church is above the law.
I'm afraid not, Mr. Crashaw. Not in these days.
It should be.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt. However, I must obviously see this child for myself.
Tell me, though, are you going as a magistrate, or is it by way of scientific investigation?
Both. And in both capacities, I'd like you to be there, Lewis.
I must say, I find it hard to credit. A child of, what, a few months?
3, when I saw it.
And with the power to... Well, to what exactly?
The power to make one feel in its presence just like a schoolboy. Harvey Walters, who vaccinated it, felt it too.
How did it do that, for heaven's sake?
By the way it had of looking at you, of sizing you up, and then... having stared you out of countenance, rejecting you.
It couldn't have been a trick of the light, say, or your imagination, or a combination of both?
Or affecting myself and Walters in the same way, not to mention Crashaw when he first encountered the infant.
But you three are the only ones to have experienced this phenomenon.
To the best of my knowledge. Oh, apart from the parents, who were also aware of, well, something special about the child. That's why I'm particularly anxious for someone else to be there when I visit.
It's now 4 or 5?
4 and a half.
You've not mentioned it to anyone in the interim.
No. I suppose I thought it would die. After I'd made life easier for the parents by offering them the cottage at Pym, I must confess I'd not thought about it again until Crashaw appeared just now.
It certainly appears to have confounded him.
It did more. It provoked him to fury. How dare it make light of his divine authority?
What did Crashaw do? Shake him?
No. He appears not to have laid hands on the child. What did he say? He didn't know how it was that he did not do the child an injury. Now, that's one of the things that interests me enormously. That power must have been retained. Along with the other developments, I really am most eager to see for myself.
I'm sure. But for the moment, I'll keep an open mind.
Oh, please sit down, Mrs. Stott, and go on with your tea.
Oh, thank you, sir, but I just finished.
We seem to be fated to intrude upon you when you're at table.
It's no intrusion, Mr. Challis, sir. But if you'll excuse me, I'll just refill his cup. He likes a second cup.
Oh, please, please, go on. I hear your son has been engaging in religious controversy with Mr. Crashaw.
Yes, sir.
Your son told you?
Oh, no, Mr. Lewis, sir. He never told me. It was Mr. Crashaw. He's been here several times lately.
He seems rather upset about it.
I'm sorry, sir, but... Well, I...
Oh, please, speak freely, Mrs. Stott. I assure you we shall respect your confidence.
Well, I can't see it's any business of Mr. Crashaw's.
He's been worrying you and your lad here.
Oh, he's not seen Mr. Crashaw again.
Sonny, you're not particularly interested in Mr. Crashaw, I suppose. I say you're not interested in Mr. Crashaw. Doesn't he hear me?
Oh, we can hear you, Mr. Challis, sir.
Mr. Crashaw is the rector, someone important, and you've been arguing with him.
Begging your pardon, take no heed, sir. He won't answer unless he's a mind to. He doesn't... Well, he doesn't speak unless he needs to. He just draws my attention and points. It's his way, sir.
Yes, yes, I see. Well, I hope that the matter of Mr. Crashaw can be settled and that you won't be bothered further.
Oh, thank you, sir. I'm very much obliged to you.
I've been wondering if I might not be able to help your son in some other way. I understand he can read.
Why, well, I learned him what I could, sir, ain't much.
Well, perhaps I could lend him a few books.
Oh, yes. We've no books, and we never hardly see a paper now either.
But you taught him.
Well, we've a Bible, and there's two copies of Lily White's Cricket Annual, as my husband left behind.
And has he read those?
The Bible he has, I believe.
All of it?
I believe so.
I'm sorry, but I find this most disconcerting. Your son obviously has an unusual power of intelligence, and we talk about him as if he wasn't here. Do you want to read? I have between 40,000 and 50,000 books in my library. I think it possible you might find one or two which would interest you.
What would I learn out of all them books?
It's a difficult question, that, eh, Lewis?
If you take the question literally...
Well, how else can we?
Well, he might learn the essential part of all knowledge that has been discovered by mankind so far.
Should I learn what I am?
No. No, that you won't learn from the books in my possession. Or indeed from any book. But you will find grounds for speculation...
Grounds for speculation.
Material from which you can formulate theories of your own.
Don't know them words. Going out now. I'll come to your library.
You let him go out by himself?
Well, he likes to be in the air, sir.
You have to let him go his own way.
Oh, yes, sir.
Well, I'll send the governor's cart for him tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Oh, that is, of course, if you've no objection to his coming.
He said he'd come, sir.
I wonder if letting him browse in my library may not be such a wise thing after all.
Why not?
Well, if that child has all the powers I credit him with, think of the possibilities of original thought if he's kept unsullied by our traditional habits of learning.
But surely some groundwork is necessary.
Is it? I wonder. I sometimes doubt whether we've ever learned anything at all that is worth knowing. Perhaps that child, if he were kept away from books...
The thing is done now.
Yes, indeed. And in any case, he'd never have been able to dodge the school attendance officer.
Have you read all these?
In effect, perhaps.
Everyone?
No, but I might say I have a nodding acquaintance with what's contained in the greater part of them.
Book about words.
A dictionary. Of course. What do you think, Lewis?
Why not? You've the latest production of the century. All the volumes are there.
Why not?
Chair. There.
Oh, no, it'll be a bit low for you. Something to raise him up, Lewis.
Books to sit on, too, eh? The Britannica should be about the right size. Half a dozen volumes, the India paper edition. Here, these should do it.
Yes, splendid. Now, if you can climb up, or shall I lift you up? Fine. Now, this is volume one, starting with letter A.
Go.
But don't you want me to explain? If you've never seen a dictionary before...
Leave me.
But...
I should leave him to it, Mr. Chalice. He's taking no account of us. We might just as well not be here. Well?
He took a biscuit and drank some milk without even looking up.
How far has he got?
Well on in letter A.
Still with volume one in front of him?
Yes.
He's consistent.
Ah. You've changed your view, then?
No. He could be humbugging us. See, he's admitted he knows very few words, yet When we saw him start on the introduction, he didn't stop to look up any of the new words he must have met there. He just ploughed on, like an adult reader.
Precisely.
Is it possible he could actually be reading as fast as that? No, he's pretending for our benefit whenever one of us is near.
I don't think so.
What's your explanation, then?
I think he's committing it to memory.
What?
They say that Macaulay had a phenomenal memory as a child. It's conceivable that this one outclasses him. The boy is, in effect, learning the whole dictionary by heart from page one, intending to collate it all later in his mind.
Oh, come.
Why not? The concentration is there. A child of five couldn't simulate that.
It's too far-fetched.
Think of the gap between your intellectual powers and that of, say, a Polynesian savage. It's possible that this child's powers equally transcend our own.
I think you're theorizing on too little evidence.
Ah, yes, you're right. We must wait. Ah, Heathcote, tell me, has the Stott child left the house?
I've not seen him, sir.
Well, then someone must have opened the library door. The handle's too high for him to reach.
The maids are off this afternoon, sir, and I certainly didn't.
This window's open.
What? Well, he could hardly...
He has, though. His footprints are in the flower bed. There.
By Jove, yes.
And see what he's done to the daffodils. Cheeky little brute.
Yes, but the logic of it. He didn't waste time trying to attract attention, just decided it was time to go and went by the shortest route.
Hmm.
Heathcote, you'd better send Jessop over to Pym. See if he's home safely.
Yes, sir. Begging your pardon, sir.
Yes?
Will the child be coming again?
I hope so. Jessop has been told to collect him each morning, and... You don't look very happy, Heathcote.
I'm sure it's not my place to comment, sir.
Regard it as another of my eccentricities. Eh, Heathcote?
Very good, sir. I'll go and tell Jessop. A glass of milk and a plate of bread and butter every day at lunchtime. That's the order. To be taken to the library. Though I don't mind telling you, it gives me the creeps. And never in all my born days did I think to see a melon-headed imp in a cricket cap ordering the master about like that. I just don't know what we're coming to, I'm sure.
The dictionary from A to Z in 5 days. Already at M in the Britannica, and still that same concentration, same rate of reading, always the same. I can't resist looking in on him time and time again. When he left last evening, he was at the end of W. He's obviously just finishing the last article in the final volume. Have you finished?
Hmm. All this. All this?
Yes.
All this.
Yes. Yes, tell me. Tell me what you think of all this.
So... elementary, inchoate, a disjunctive patchwork. If this presents, in essence, the sum of human knowledge, then...
It means nothing to you, then?
I find no relationship. Concepts of space and time are postulated, come to be taken as absolute. Yet how reconcile them with a physical and material universe that is described here, leading to philosophies which are no longer systems of thought, analysing, specifying, working deductively or inductively, ethical basis for conduct, when all the time the spheres in which these creeds operate, and that same history which forms so critical an element in politics. How is it used? How does it function? And as to the underlying motivations, what function? What purpose? Why? These appear not to be cared about. Only how is a matter of concern. And even there, such answers as may be presented are irrelevant, or at best non sequiturs. If this is all, there is a great void, a great emptiness here.
I find... Well, I cannot dispute your analysis. And yet all you've seen, all you've described, it's not like that.
Yes. To me. From the outside.
From the outside?
I find no comprehension of the infinite oneness of space and time, of the wholeness of being. I see no appreciation of ultimate finality or of infinity, both of which coexist.
How can we appreciate either?
How can you not?
It isn't in us. Not yet.
Not yet. Is there then no one else that sees? Is there none of my kind? Is this all?
There is none of your kind.
May I introduce Mr. Foreman?
Oh, how do you do?
How do you do? Fine day.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Well, Mr. Crashaw, you asked me to call.
Yes. The child, Victor Stott. I gather that for some time now he's been spending the greater part of his day playing in your library.
If you remember, I undertook to find some way of diverting his mind, so as to prevent him speaking against religion to the yokels.
Seems quite a character, if I may say so.
He hasn't been offending in that way.
No, but neither does he receive instruction in any sacred subject, nor, for that matter, attend Sunday school or any place of worship.
Well, what is it you want me to do now?
Possibly you've realized that the child is well past his fifth birthday.
I suppose he must be.
Past the age at which the state requires him to receive the elements of education.
Eh?
Time he went to school. I've been after him, you know. I'm the attendance officer for the district. It's a serious matter. Come now.
Oh, forgive me. Of course you don't know, you can't possibly know, the utter absurdity of putting that child to recite the multiplication table with village infants of his own age.
I fail to see any absurdity in the proposition, Mr. Challis.
Five is the age fixed by the state.
Well, how can I explain? But let me take an instance. You teach him the elements of arithmetic.
It's part of the curriculum.
Well, I've only had one true conversation with this child, but in the course of it he had occasion to refer, by way of illustration, to some abstruse theorem of the differential calculus. His aim was to make his meaning clear on a particular point. Though I may say the illustration was utterly beyond me.
God bless me. You don't say so.
The reference was an act of intellectual condescension.
If the child is, as you infer, some sort of mathematical genius, and it's true there have been instances in history, he would not, of course, receive elementary instruction in that subject.
You would not find any subject, believe me, Crashaw, in which he could be instructed by any teacher in a council school.
There, I cannot agree with you. He is sadly in need of some religious instruction.
He would not get that in a council school.
No, indeed. Why not bring the child here and let the Reverend Mr. Crashaw or myself put a few questions to him?
If I brought him, he wouldn't answer your questions. He's very difficult to deal with.
Oh, is he? Of course, I've not spoken to him.
In any case, the decision does not rest with us.
No. No, it rests with the local authority.
Which has the right to prosecute.
The parent is responsible, may be brought before a magistrate and fined for the first offence.
I shan't fine her if she comes before me.
Well, of course, no one wishes to proceed to extremes. But you, Mr. Challis, are the one who has most influence in the matter. I cannot believe that you will go against the established authority of both church and state, if only for the sake of example.
Mr. Crashaw, regulations, laws, religious and lay authorities come into existence in order to deal with the rule, the average. But if we are reasoning, intelligent people, we must also have some means of dealing with the exception, for whom a particular law can have no application. Are we to exhibit a crass stupidity by enforcing it? Or are we, as reasoning, intelligent men, going to take the case into our own hands and act according to the dictates of common sense?
I don't agree with you. I don't consider this an exception.
You must agree with me, Crashaw. I have a certain amount of influence, and I shall use it.
In that case, I shall fight you to the bitter end. I am determined that this infidel child shall go to school, that he shall find and occupy his preordained place in the order of society.
Quite right. Very right.
I think you would be better advised to let the matter rest. It's possible.
I shall fight.
Very well. As you think best. I don't know if you're aware, Mrs. Stott, that the English education system requires every child to attend school from the age of 5, unless the parents are able to provide approved instruction elsewhere.
No, sir, I didn't know.
The Elementary Education Act of 1870 and its subsequent amendments. Yes.
Ah. Now, there is an individual... why shouldn't you know? It's the Reverend Mr. Crashaw again, who insists that you should attend the elementary school.
Oh, I thought we were shot of him, sir.
I have argued with him. I've also seen this afternoon, in point of fact, a friend of mine, who is chairman of the Education Authority. What has emerged is that you can't be exempted unless you're able to convince the authority that you should be.
Cannot you stand in loco parentis?
Oh, in that I'm providing you with an education.
Yes.
Hmm. There's still Crashaw to deal with.
Inform me.
He can't or won't understand. I know these things must seem to you utterly absurd, but I'm sure you realize that you are an exception to the world about us. People like Crashaw, like myself, indeed all of us, from the meanest to the greatest minds of the day, are not subject to the fine logic you exercise. Well, that being so, you must also realize that whatever your wisdom, you have to live in this world of comparative ignorance. A world that cannot appreciate you, which could fall back on compulsion, even the use of physical force.
You suggest, then?
That you consent to answer certain elementary questions which a few selected members of the local authority will put to you.
What are these members?
There are 4 of them. Their chairman, he's the friend I mentioned, Sir Dean Elmer. He's a man of open mind, an amateur scientist of some note, with a progressive outlook. And then there's the former mayor, Councillor Purvis. Oh, he's the grocer, Purvis and Company. You'll know the shop, Mrs. Stott, in the square at Aylesworth.
Oh, yes, sir. Well, ain't he another churchman, though?
A lay preacher, I believe. But on the authority, he represents the trading interest.
The other two?
The headmaster of the grammar school, Mr. Stephen. So that's another man of learning. And finally, there's Mr. Standing, who's the political appointee.
Will you be there, sir?
Yes, yes. Oh, and Crashaw, I'm afraid.
Oh.
But the examination will be conducted here, in the library, so there will be minimal interruption in your studies. Now, will you consent?
I'll answer their questions. Let them come.
Well, I think, Stephen, your best place to conduct the examination. Will you open the proceedings?
Yes, very well. Now then, tell me, what is the square root of 226?
15.03329 divide places.
Dear me, is that right?
I think so. 225 is 15 squares.
What's that book he's got in front of him? It's not a crib, is it?
May I see? Ah, yes. Spinoza, the short treatise. Van Vleuten's Dutch text and Latin translation.
What? Well, what's all that about, then?
It has nothing to do with elementary arithmetic. Mr. Stephen will reassure you on that point.
Certainly.
All right, then. What does half a stone of loaf sugar at 2 3 farthings come to?
Don't recognize the terminology employed.
What is 7 times 2 3/4?
19.25.
What's that in shillings?
1.60416.
Wrong.
I think not, Mr. Purvis.
Right.
Examinee has given the correct mathematical answer to 5 places of decimals, so far as I can check him mentally.
Well, it seems to have gone a long way round. Mm. Just to do a sum as any fifth standard child could do in his head.
Yeah.
I'll give him another.
I thought Mr. Stephen had been delegated to conduct the first part of his examination.
Will you go on, Mr. Stephen? Perhaps something a little more advanced. Mm.
What is the binomial theorem?
A formula for writing down the coefficient of any stated term in the expansion of any stated power of a given binomial.
I am satisfied under this head.
Beyond me, you don't mind saying so.
I think, Mr. Chairman, we've had enough theoretical arithmetic. There's a few practical questions I'd like to put.
Yes, Mr. Purvis.
Yeah. How old was our Lord when he began his ministry?
Uncertain.
Huh. Well, come now. Any Sunday school child knows that.
Of course. Of course.
Mr. Crashaw, please.
Are you sure, Mr. Purvis, you've understood the purport of the answer?
Oh, of course I am. I asked how old our Lord was when he began his ministry, and he says he is uncertain.
He meant that the answer to your question is uncertain.
Well, how's that? I have always understood...
Quite, but what we've always understood does not always correspond to the actual fact.
If you don't mind, Chalice. Now, what did you intend by your answer?
The evidence rests mainly on Luke's gospel, but the phrase Archominos Hosei Eton Triaconta is vague. It allows latitude in either direction. According to the chronology of John's gospel, the age might have been about 32.
Well, it says 30 in the Bible, and that's good enough for me.
Heresy. Heresy.
Well, it sounds like blasphemy to me, doubting the word of God. I am for sending him to school.
All in good time, Mr. Purvis. Now tell me, how many elements are known to chemists?
81 well characterized. Others have been described.
And which has the greatest atomic weight?
Uranium.
And the weight is?
On the oxygen basis of 16, 238.5.
Nothing else, extraordinary powers of memory.
What's your opinion of tariff reform?
An empirical question that cannot be decided from a theoretical basis.
What are you to say to that, Standing?
I say that tariff reform is the only way to save the country. And if this government is not...
For mercy's sake... Are we here to argue the trivialities of present-day politics? Aren't you satisfied? What more evidence do you need?
I'm not satisfied. Nor is the Reverend Crashaw, I fancy.
He has no vote. Elmer, what do you say?
I think we may say that the child has been and is being educated satisfactorily elsewhere, and that he need not attend the elementary school.
On a point of order, Mr. Chairman... Is that what you put to the meeting?
Well, this is quite informal. Our findings will be put to the full education
committee. That's all very well.
Well, shall we argue the point in the other room?
Mm-hmm. Yes, certainly, certainly. And our examinee can get back to his Spinoza.
I apologize for my fellow children.
No more.
What do you mean?
They are the last. Your kind have no interest in truth. So no more.
Of these events in the life of Victor Stott, the Hamptonshire Wonder, I, of course, at the time, knew nothing. Now, on my returning, however, it was to that corner of Hamptonshire and to Pym itself that my steps turned. The vagaries of fortune had provided me with the means and the leisure to fulfil an old ambition, to write a book, a work of philosophy which would attempt to reconcile a conflicting variety of viewpoints and theories. Those former visits of mine to Pym had established it, by its very isolation, as an ideal place to embark on such a task, and I had engaged a room for the summer at a local farm.
Hold on to your luggage, Mr. Davies. We're going to have to pull over to the side here. Let this lot pass us by. Come on, girl.
There's not a lot of room on the road.
You can't rightly call it a road. Disgrace it is. Oh, no, girl.
They're well and truly loaded. Someone moving house?
Ah.
I say, Bates, that's not the, not the Stott child.
Where?
On that cart. Didn't you see? Great swollen head, slobbering mouth.
Come on, girl. Lord bless you, no. That's the Harrison boy, with his mother. Old Harrison's dead. Wrong anywhere. Moved away from here 5 or 6 years ago. Now she and the boy have come back. Worse luck. Thought we'd be shot of them.
The boy's an idiot, is he?
Yeah, horrible. Can't speak nor nothing. He goes about bleating and barring like an old sheep.
And the Stotts? Do they still live at Pym?
Not Ginger. He's over at Aylesworth. But Mrs. Stott and her son lives here.
Are the boys still alive, then?
Ah.
Intelligent child?
Oh, so they say. For an 8-year-old. Book learning and such. They say he's read every book in Mr. Chalice's library.
Does he go to school?
Oh, no, they let him off. Leastways, Mr. Chalice did. They say Reverend Crashaw down at Stoke were fair put out about it.
My memory had been stirred. And as I crossed the common next day, passing the pond where Ginger Stott had told me of his dwindling hopes, I remembered his ambition for the child, to teach it to become the world's greatest bowler, to ensure it stayed uncorrupted by any habit that might interfere with that aim. And I remembered, too, my resolve to be a part of that child's life, its protector and mentor.
May I come in?
Mr. Davis, yes, please do.
How are you, Mrs. Stott?
Oh, we're both very well, thank you. And yourself? It's a long time.
It is indeed. I had to go abroad suddenly and have only recently returned.
Oh, I see.
And this is your boy. I hear he's a great scholar.
Oh, yes, sir.
You won't remember me, I shouldn't think. You were still in baby clothes the last time I saw you.
Oh, yes, sir. He remembers. He never forgets anything.
I hear you're a great reader. What have you been reading? I've come to spend the summer here. I'm staying at Bates Farm.
Oh, yes. I go there for our milk and eggs and things.
I brought a great many books with me. I thought perhaps he might care to read some of them.
Well, he's given up reading the past 6 weeks, sir, but I dare say he'll come and see your books.
Would you?
No.
I beg your pardon?
He'll go with you. Now.
Oh. Oh, splendid. Ah, Mrs. Stott.
Oh.
Just calling for your provisions.
That's right, sir.
The lad got home all right last evening.
Oh, yes. He's used to coming and going as he pleases, ever since he could first walk.
Mrs. Stott, I want to understand about your son.
Yes. Well, he hardly ever speaks to me.
But you understand each other.
In some ways, sir.
What perturbs me is, well, what is he going to do? When he grows up, I mean.
I can't say, sir. We must leave that to him.
Well, I wonder, is there any way in which I could be of use to him?
Well,
yeah?
There is a way you could help him, if you would.
Well, tell me.
Well, I hope I'm not asking too much.
What is it?
It's the Harrison boy. He's a brute beast, if you know what I mean, sir. And since he come back, he's been hanging round my boy, like he did before they went away.
He was here yesterday. I sent him packing.
Was he? Here at the farm?
Yes. He didn't molest the lad on his way home.
No, I don't think so. He never said, but then he wouldn't. Thing is, though, he don't seem to have the same hold over that boy as he does over others. What I was thinking, sir, was that if you go with him when he takes his walks, well, I think he'd be glad of your company.
You do?
He seems to have taken a fancy to you, sir. He won't say as much, but I sometimes know his meaning without the need of any words.
I see. Yes, certainly, I'll come and fetch him. Who knows? It may be a way of coming to understand him a little better. The principal reason for my presence on those walks, however, the Harrison oaf, was rarely in evidence. Although there was one occasion when he summoned up courage enough to approach us.
Oh. Let him be.
But I thought... The idiot's behaviour was that of a nervous puppy wishing to propitiate some as yet unknown master. He was within a few feet of us, crouching and wriggling in the grass, when the wonder gave him one of his deliberate, devastating stares that I remembered so well from that first encounter on the train. The idiot, however, regarded this as a sign of encouragement, and he came nearer still, at last reaching out a hand to touch the boy he so curiously regarded as a playmate.
No. Send him away.
All right, that'll do.
Send him away.
Get away, will you? Go on, or you'll feel my stick about you. The wonder made no comment on the incident as we walked home. He had shown no sign of fear, and it occurred to me that my guardianship of him was merely a convenience, not a protection from any danger. Moreover, doubts began to grow in my mind as to the wonder's learning and intelligence. Perhaps it was no more than an unprecedented memory, manifesting itself in some kind of freak pedantry. Nevertheless, I could not break away.
I was grappled to the wonder by bonds whose nature I could not fathom. I resolved to consult the one other person who had some intimate awareness of the wonder's abilities.
And this is where he acquired the main body of his knowledge.
I suppose so. As far as I know, he's had no other access to books.
No wonder he spent so little time on the meager collection I brought with me. He probably read them all here.
And in their original languages. He learns a language as you or I would learn a page of history.
Do you really believe that he's assimilated all this?
It defeats the imagination. But yes, I do.
You say he did talk to you at length on one occasion.
Yes, in the early days. Later he was happily less forthcoming.
Happily? Why do you say that? What did he talk about?
To tell you the truth, I have a very confused memory of what he said. And what little I might remember, I prefer to leave undisturbed.
But why?
I suppose. Partly vanity. I don't enjoy being made to feel like an immature schoolboy.
I'm with you there. It's like being confronted with some elaborate theorem of the higher mathematics. Is it possible, one says, that anyone can understand these things?
Precisely.
But in fact, I suppose someone does. The mathematician, whose trained mind is far in advance of us, the non-mathematicians.
I don't think that you could compare that knowledge gap with the one that exists between us and the Stotchild.
Can't we try to bridge it? Learn from him?
There are no data to bridge the gap.
He used those words to me once.
Oh, you've been favored then.
So it would seem.
In man's few thousand years on Earth so far, it's only a feeble store of knowledge that he has accumulated. I suppose this library contains a fair summary of it. Over the years, other books will be added to it as step-by-step knowledge is increased. But it is only step-by-step.
Nevertheless, it seems to me that this child knows a great many things which we have been patiently trying to discover since the dawn of civilization.
I admit that. But, well, I don't think I want to know.
He could give us the key, I'm sure of that.
We're not ready for it. You can't teach metaphysics to children.
I shall go on. There are those moments of almost comprehension, occasional flashes of illumination. Somehow this vast resource must be tapped. Yes, I shall go on. This newly found resolve had taken the best part of a day to grow in me. I had gone to Chalice Court early in the morning, stayed for lunch, and as a result, missed my afternoon appointment to accompany the wonder. As I entered my lodging at Bates Farm, I was confronted by an anxious figure.
He's not with you?
Mrs. Stott.
Have you seen him?
No. I'm sorry I didn't come to collect him today, but I was
delayed. He hasn't been into his tea. I've been up on the common looking for him.
Well, he may have made a mistake in the time.
He never makes a mistake in the time. He always knows the time to the minute without clock or watch. Why did you leave him alone?
I have said I'm sorry. And it isn't as if he's not used to going out on his own.
He's never been late before, not a minute. And now it's an hour after his time.
Come now, calm yourself. He may even be at home by now. Let's go and see.
But the child was not there. And it was not long before the woman's agitation began to affect me. I sent a neighbour to notify Chalice, and meeting Bates in the lane, told him to find out if any of his people had seen the boy, and if not, to start searching the common. When I arrived back at the cottage, the sun was already setting. I met Chalice in the lane.
Has he come back?
No. There'll be a madwoman in that cottage if we don't find him by nightfall.
I've been up Dean Hill. There was no sign of him there.
Ah, Heathcote, any news?
Not between here and the court, sir.
Well, take our people and try the woods.
Well, I shan't be able to do much tonight, sir. It'll be dark in half an hour.
Well, do what you can in half an hour.
Oh, very good, sir.
He's such a little chap. It would be easy to miss him if he were unconscious.
Darkness fell, and with it the rain came, and still the wonder had not been found. Mrs. Bates stayed with Ellen Mary, and the two kept their silent vigil. I pictured them in the cottage, and wondered how near the latter was to the limit of human endurance. But, lulled by the rain, I eventually fell asleep. Once during the night, I awoke suddenly and thought I heard a long, wailing cry out on the common. But when I got up and looked out, and the cry was not repeated, I wasn't sure whether or not I had dreamed it. Another image between sleeping and waking had me sitting bolt upright as the daylight streamed in. The pond. No one had looked in the pond.
Can you see anything, sir?
No. Wait. If I hang on to the tree, I can lean out.
Careful, sir. All right. I've got your arm.
Ah.
See something, sir?
Well, I'm not sure. It's white in the mud on the bottom. It could be a bit of a broken basin or something. Give me that torn branch there.
Here you are, sir. Kids have been using it by the look of it.
Yes, it's long enough to reach the bottom. Oh, my God.
What is it, sir?
Pull me back, Bates. Pull me clear. I'm afraid I'm going to be sick.
The men made a chair of their arms as they carried him down the lane. No one had any fear of him now. That little body with its pale head, still too large for it, drooping now. I was reminded, disgustingly, of children with a guy. Then from nowhere, the Harrison idiot shambled up.
Now then, you. Cut along off. Keep away. Keep your hands off him.
He passed me as he ran, stumbling and scrambling, and I saw his face suffused with terror. The one creature who had never feared the wonder living now feared him horribly when he was dead. The coroner's jury returned a verdict of accidental death. But I knew perfectly well that the wonder did not fall into the pond by accident. He was too perfectly controlled. I know that he was pushed into the pond. I know that he was held down and pressed into the mud, probably with that very branch from the ash tree which I had used to discover him. I hope it was the Harrison idiot who was to blame, but I doubt it. So there is but one other person who could have been implicated, one who went beyond fear into hatred. I recall all the terrifying acts of misapplied courage and ferocious brutality that the fanatics of history have been capable of when their creed and their authority have been set at naught, and how many of those hateful deeds had been done in the name of a cause whose founder preached a doctrine of love. So I said nothing, and indeed I hesitate even now to name him, but I know it was the Reverend Percy Crashaw who destroyed what he feared and hated. As for the others in this story, Ellen Mary Stott was broken quite by the death of her God. She never recovered her sanity and died not long after in the county asylum. I heard that her husband attended the funeral. And Henry Challice, the only one whom the Hamptonshire wonder had favoured with an adumbration of the world into which he had found himself born.
Tell me, why do you not want to talk about what you heard from him that afternoon?
I glimpsed a finality, and that appalled me. Ignorance is the means of our intellectual pleasure. It's the solving of the problem that brings enjoyment. The solved problem has no further interest. When all is known, the stimulus for action ceases.
And for Victor Stott, all was known.
Precisely. Pity the child for whom there could be no mystery. The first and greatest joy of life. In our childhood, there is unexplained mystery, just beyond the gate. When that is explored, there are new and wonderful possibilities beyond the hills, and then beyond the seas, beyond the known world, and so into the world of imagination, of speculation.
And he reached that point in a few weeks.
And even further beyond. His vision of the world, of the cosmos itself, was something utterly beyond our comprehension. And in our present infantile state, what we cannot comprehend, we must fear.
I believe he was beginning to understand that.
Too late, though. Someone feared him enough to destroy him. And we breathe again. Relieved. Suppose that unique brain, that pure, untrammeled intellect, had not been burdened with all the dead weight of information, of facts. What then?
We can never know. Now.
No. Still, the world is young yet. Let's play in the nursery of our times. The day will come when humanity has grown to his mental stature. But not in our day. Not for 1,000 years.
The wonder is buried in the churchyard over at Chilborough, well away from the Reverend Percy Crashaw's parish. The stone bears the initials V.S. and a date. People speak of him as that poor little boy of Mrs. Stott's. No one remembers that he had been in any way different from other poor little fellows who had died an untimely death.
That was The Hamptonshire Wonder by Geoffrey Siegel, based on J.D. Beresford's novel of the same name. The narrator, John Davis, was played by Jonathan Newth. Ginger Stott was Steve Hodson, Mary Ellen Stott, Carol Boyd, and Victor Stott, Vicky Ireland. Henry Challice, Richard Herndl, the Reverend Percy Crashaw, Hugh Dixon, Dr. O'Connor, Crawford Logan, the nurse, Penelope Brownjohn, Mrs. Reed, Catherine Parr. Gregory Lewis was Richard Gibson, Heathcote, John Forbes Robertson, the Harrison boy, Robin Langford. Mr. Stephen, Frank Ellis, Mr. Foreman, Bruce Alexander, Sir Dean Elmer, Geoffrey Siegel, and Bates and the man on the train, David Goodison. Mr. Purvis and Mr. Standing were played by Steve Hodson and Crawford Logan. The Hamptonshire Wonder was directed by Christopher Venning.